Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sometimes you have to step way back to see what's going on in the world. President Bush steps back and sees a fight of good and evil. Writer James Carroll steps back and sees 60-plus years of the Pentagon driving an American predilection toward war. Carroll grew up the son of an Air Force general in the endless corridors of the five-sided heart of American military power in Washington. Today, he says, Americans are so deep in the grip of a war-making view of the world that they don't even see it. And even the pushback of generals on Iraq won't stop it. Up next on Point, Fear and Loathing from World War II to Iraq, the case for America as prisoner of the Pentagon. Later in this hour, we'll be joined by West Point man and military historian Andrew Bacevich. Joining me now in the studio is James Carroll, columnist for the Boston Globe and best-selling author of Constantine's Sword and American Requiem, for which he won the National Book Award. His new book is House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power. James Carroll, thanks for being here.
Greetings, Tom.
So, you quote the poet Theodore Rothke here, saying, "In a dark time, the eye begins to see." And what your eye sees at the center of American troubles is the Pentagon. That takes us slightly from an oblique angle these days, when we've seen generals pushing back against Pentagon policy that many see as having originated in the White House. Why are you training your fire on the big five-sided building over there?
Well, seeing is the point. In traditional Aristotelian narrative terms, the climax of the tragic play is the catastrophe. Another word for that is the epiphany. It's the point when the action of the play is revealed and we see what's been going on below the surface all this time. Oedipus sees that he's the killer of the king. Post 9/11, culminating now in this disastrous war in Iraq, we can see not just the mistakes of George W. Bush, but a dynamic that's embedded in American life that goes back to World War II. We see now that there's been this unchecked, impersonal momentum, part bureaucratic, involving not just the military, the political establishment, the executive branch of government, but also academia, social structures generally, the labor movement, the broad culture. We have become an economy, a people, dependent on the preparation for, the readiness for, the anticipation of war. And to see this, we can go right back to 1943 and follow the story through a series of crossroads where at each crucial moment, take two obvious ones. 1968, America voted against the war in Vietnam. It ran on for another 7 years. Why? 1989, the Cold War ended. The other side dismantled its structure of Cold War. We didn't. Why? There's a momentum that I'm addressing in this book, and that's my strong concern. And I believe it's being now seen for what it is, the militarization of American life.
It's a personal story for you. Your father, an Air Force general, I think the founding head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, that's been much in the news lately. You spent your childhood running around the halls of that great big building on the Potomac.
I have memories, Tom, of on Saturdays, of course, in my youth, the Pentagon was, as the American federal government was generally, an open institution. There were restricted zones in the Pentagon. I remember the gates at the restricted areas that where the Joint Chiefs had their offices.
But a kid of a general might go running down the hallways.
Well,
and
there were these great ramps. I remember taking my shoes off and sliding down the ramps of the Pentagon in my stocking feet, feeling somehow like I was in violation in doing that. But no one ever stopped me. I had the free run of the place. That's in my early childhood. As a high school student, I went to high school in Washington, and on my way home from school, I would go to the Pentagon to ride the rest of the way home to Alexandria with my dad, and I would check in at his office. His secretary would tell me when to come back. Often it would be at 7:30 or 8, and I would have the place to explore, to do my homework in the snack bar, to check out the portraits on the walls. I really did feel a bond with the place. And I'll tell you that on 9/11, when our nation was so traumatized...
And the Pentagon was hit.
Well, and the focus of our grief went to the World Trade Center for obvious reasons. But the thing that really took me by surprise was the grief and sorrow I felt in connection to the hit building on the edge of the Potomac.
60 years before that day, the dedication of the Pentagon, you turned around hugely on this building, became a big anti-war activist in the Vietnam era, a priest, partly a Catholic priest, partly in response to your rejection of all that. What was it that you've come to see in the Pentagon that was new in American history? War was not new in American history. So when the spade was put in to build the Pentagon, when it was completed, what did that represent that was new? What was the difference?
Well, in a way, war was new. I mean, we did have a savage civil war in the 19th century, but
Spanish-American, Mexican, yes, invaded the Philippines, took it
true.
Over.
We have a long history of military adventure. That's certainly true. But on the eve of World War II, the United States of America had a military power that was way down the list of other nations. We weren't a warlike people at that point. Not to use the word warlike now, but I would say that World War II, the massive mobilization of World War II, finding ourselves in contest with a savage, malign enemies, Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany, we did find ourselves in the grip of something new. And, of course, that grip was vice-like, especially because of the new technologies that came into play then. House of War begins in 1 week, 1943, the week the Pentagon was dedicated, also the week that Los Alamos really gets up and running, so nuclear power really has its...
And weaponry.
And that same week was the real beginning of strategic bombing when the United States Air Force, the Army Air Forces, joined forces with the Royal Air Force to bomb the cities of Germany.
Kind of carpet urban bombing, high civilian
urban,
death.
Urban bombing in the American experience begins then, that same week. And the other thing that happens that week is Franklin Roosevelt adopts the policy of unconditional surrender of the Axis powers, which will lead directly to the savage assaults against Japanese cities at the end of World War II, something not reckoned with yet in this country, I would say. We simply haven't looked directly. It's not just about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 60 or more Japanese cities were leveled by American strategic bombers in the last 5 months of the war. Historians are not clear on what the casualty figures are, but some respectable historians put them at as high as 900,000 civilians killed in the last few months of the war. We haven't really reckoned with that either. So look what began in that week, in that period. Nuclear, strategic bombing, a spirit of total war, unprecedented, all embodied and managed by this institution that began at the same moment.
You're
Pentagon.
A former priest and peace activist. I think no small number of people may listen and nod along with you, but many others will say, it's been a dangerous century. Thank heavens we had a big Pentagon there. It was Nazi Germany. It was Emperor Hirohito's Japan. These were large military powers. Thank heavens that it was built on the banks of the Potomac. Thank heavens it became strong. Are you saying that, that the United States should have had a Gandhian peace policy, or that this has just gone too far somehow?
Well, I think we need to, first of all, I acknowledge and I fully acknowledge in House of War the achievement of the World War II generation, the defeat of Nazism, fascism, imperialism, a crucial act of good. What I'm concerned with is that there was a dark side to that triumph, which we haven't attended to. There's a dark side to war, even just war. We have to be aware of it. When the momentum of war takes hold of the human heart, even in a so-called just war, some very, very tragic things begin to happen, and we have to pay attention to that. And that's what I'm trying to reckon with here. And there are some. So I asked some obvious questions. Why was it in 1989 when the Berlin Wall was brought down nonviolently against the predictions of every so-called Russian expert or Soviet expert? Why was it that the American response was immediately to invade Panama and then not so immediately to resolve the test with Saddam Hussein in 1991 with an act of war, against, by the way, the recommendations of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
And to push NATO right up to Russia's new boundaries.
And you know, to effectively violate the agreements that the United States of America made with the Soviet Union to expand NATO at that point, pushing Russia in an ever more defensive posture. We see that being played out even today with the celebration of and the possibility of further expansion of NATO. So what I'm asking, you know, this isn't a the cri de coeur of a peacenik. I am a peacenik, unabashed and unashamed. But in this book, I try to take as seriously as I can the work of history, the points of view of those who disagree with me, and also kind of test idealism against realism at every turn. And my conclusion is very firm, which is that we're on a terribly wrong path. We've become all too much a war culture, a war people, and we simply have to stop it. And the momentum I'm describing is still at work. We can see it pushing us towards something in Iran, which is the next case in point, against all rationality, against any realistic strategy that makes sense.
We're joined as well now in the studio by Andrew Bacevich. He's professor of international relations at Boston University, expert in American diplomatic and military history, West Point graduate, was colonel in the U.S. Army, author most recently of The New American Militarism, earlier of American Empire. Andrew Bacevich, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello.
There's a lot more we want to hear from James Carroll here, but I want to begin to get your voice in this conversation. You've written about militarism in the United States. You've bemoaned it, said it's risen to a point that it's dangerous. So when you hear this kind of sweeping critique of the Pentagon that says it goes right back to this building and the culture that lives there, as a former military man who's also been critical, how do you hear this critique?
I had a chance to read James Carroll's book over the weekend, and it's a very fine book. I'm a little bit troubled by what I think is a gap between the title of the book and the actual argument, which he has so ably summarized. That is to say, the argument, if I understand it, is that we have become a militarized people, but the title of the book, House of War, points to this building. And I endorse his argument. I'm a little bit concerned that people will use the title in a sense to try to blame the problem on either the officer corps or Mr. Rumsfeld or this particular administration.
You're saying it's not the Pentagon in particular?
It's not the Pentagon. The Pentagon is part of it, certainly. The Pentagon plays a role. But to the extent that we have become too militarized, let's let the Congress share in the blame. Let's let the civilians, hawkish civilians in the State Department, share in the blame. Let's let many of sort of the chattering members of the chattering classes share in the blame, who are advocating military solutions to whatever the problems. So this is an enormous issue that ought not to be simply reduced to saying, oh, it's the five-sided building, that's the problem. Blow up the five-sided building and the problem goes away. I don't think it would.
James Carroll, but yet that's exactly where you look as you follow the taproot. Why do you focus so tightly on this very large institution?
Well, I actually quite agree with Colonel Bacevich in the point he just made. And I try to, in the book, acknowledge the complications here. I am using the Pentagon as a broad symbol for this cultural militarization. I take pains to point out that again and again and again, down through the decades, there have been military men, and always men, in the Pentagon who've opposed their much more warlike civilian overseers. So we see Dean Acheson as the person who wants to go to war in Korea, against George Marshall, General Marshall, right through, you know, Robert McNamara's warlike impulses early in the Vietnam War are well known, the civilian. The State Department itself has been militarized in this process. When I use the word Pentagon, I'm talking broadly about the militarization of the government that has included the State Department. John Foster Dulles, through the 50s, having much more influence over the growth of America's military stance in the world than the succession of defense secretaries in the Pentagon. So it's a very, and of course, the Congress. The Pentagon is the is the headquarters. You could think of the ground zero, the center of the Pentagon, that courtyard in the middle of the five-sided building as the home base of the Iron Triangle, the Iron Quadrangle, the, you know, that unbreakable mix of power centers. And I do believe, actually, it does make sense to locate it in the Pentagon. This is the place where this unbelievably unprecedented economic, political, cultural behemoth resides.
But let's take the contrast to its fullest extent, maybe, to test this. Is it the Pentagon, then, as ground zero here, or, go all the way, is it the American people? Are the American people a warlike people? Now, some may not agree with that at all, but both of you say that there's a rise in militarism, so is this organic to our country and culture, or something imposed or located in a, you know, a dark center, as you would have it?
Well, I'm trying to pay attention, trying to understand what happened to us as a nation. I do not want to be understood simply as blaming, for example, the officer corps or even federal appointees or even... No, there is definitely something at work in the American psyche. It's post-World War II. I argue that something happened at the end of World War II, a combination of the massive crimes of strategic bombing and the coming of the atomic bomb, that we've never found ourselves able to look at. I do believe, as a people, we are suffering from what one historian calls atomic amnesia. And until we look more directly at that, why didn't we dismantle our nuclear arsenal at the end of the Cold War? Why didn't we? It's because...
Or share it with the Soviet Union, as some in the United States suggested, rather than race them.
Early on, yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, this does go to the American people. We're the ones who don't press the Democrats to raise the question of the war in Iraq. Why is there no political benefit to a Democratic candidate, even today, to be aggressive in criticizing this war?
But where's the end of your critique? Your book's subtitle is The Disastrous Rise of American Power. I think an awful lot of Americans would scratch their heads at that and say, well, we have Pax Americana, the world knew peace and prosperity like never before. You know, that's the framing that a lot of people bring to the rise of American power. Not disastrous. Why disastrous?
It's true. Well, we're standing on the edge of an abyss. We've been very lucky over the decades not to have fallen into that abyss. I'm not so confident that we won't fall into it yet. And the 21st
talking
century...
Talking of nuclear warfare
well,
abyss?
Well, nuclear warfare, now the threat of proliferation that I would argue is American-sponsored... at this point, it's true that the Soviet Union dismantled itself and has gone as the world-threatening enemy. But we've created a new kind of world-threatening enemy.
I want to begin to turn to our listeners. Michael's calling from Miami, Florida. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Michael?
Well, there's a lot of really interesting points being brought out, and I wasn't in the country for 9/11. I was living out of the country for a few years, and I came back Christmas of 2001, and there is an elevation, a level of warlike traditions that are just being a little bit pushed a little bit harder now. For instance, the Super Bowl 2002, the one after 9/11 we had, and it was like had a military feel to it. There was a lot of militarism that's being pushed, and I have a comment about how we were at the end of World War II. I'm only 37 years old, and
okay.
I see that as the last noble war that this planet's ever seen, because we were truly fighting a visible evil. And my thing is, like, we were having a fist fight and we ended it with a gun, with the nuclear bomb, and our brothers that we were fighting with noticed the power of that thing, and they wanted one as too, but I feel as Americans that we didn't want anyone else to have that power, and that's created a whole element of untrust and spying and stuff like that. I thought after World War II we put everything on the table and let's live in peace, like brothers and sisters. But I'm afraid that the Pentagon is kind of crazy, and I hate to say that word, but I'm a bit spooked.
We hear it, Michael, and we thank you for your call. And Andrew Bacevich, let me turn to you on this issue of the path we've traveled and how much choice was involved. You know, military conflicts are always presented as necessary. When Americans look back, of course, Vietnam was deeply disputed. But when we went in, it was JFK going in, and there was the communist threat. I mean, do you agree that the United States has chosen war against real alternatives repeatedly, as James Carroll suggests?
I think there's always alternatives. Important themes of the book, at least as I read it, is the way he emphasizes. James Carroll emphasizes the extent to which our domestic politics has come to be distorted as a consequence of this militarism. The time and again post-World War II period, the ambitious candidate who wants to win high elective office, in particular the presidency, chooses a strategy of trying to scare the electorate, that the incumbent is weak. I will be strong. I will be tough. The dangers are great. Elect me. I will keep you safe. That has happened over and over and over again in a very calculating and, I think, a cynical way. James Carroll referred in the first segment to our unwillingness to reckon with our experience in World War II, particularly strategic bombing. True. We are also unwilling to reckon with the poverty of our democratic politics. And I think that there, too, the unwillingness to reckon with reality, to look reality in the face, helps to perpetuate this penchant to look for military solutions to difficult problems.
But the suggestion here is that if we hadn't gone to war, we would have had peace, which is the opposite of what we're always told. That if we laid down our guns, there would be peace. We're told again and again the best defense is a good offense. The best guard against war mm-hmm. is to be so powerfully prepared for war that no one wants to challenge. Yeah,
and I would be the last one. James Carroll said that he's an unabashed peacenik. I'm an unabashed realist, so I'm not in favor of weakness, and I really don't think that world peace is going to be coming anytime soon. But, and this is the big but, from a realist perspective, one really ought to be wary about how much of a solution force can offer. Force does solve problems at times, but force almost inevitably creates new problems. So you go into it with your eyes open, not somehow promising that at the other end of this war, world peace will beckon.
Dan's calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Good day.
Good day, sir. What are you thinking?
Mr. Carroll, I wonder if you are familiar with the story that President Eisenhower's famous departure speech in 1960 originally was written with the warning of the military-industrial congressional complex, but that Ike was counseled to strike the word congressional from the speech, which he did. And I wonder if you'd comment on that to the extent that you're familiar with it. And I also would like to call attention to that our local public radio station, KSFC here in Spokane, is currently running underwriting spots for the documentary film Why We Fight, which is a concurrent ratification, I think, of Mr. Carroll's book. And a major thesis of this film is the old journalistic maxim, investigative journalistic maxim, if you will, that when you want to know what's going on and why, you follow the money. And that the U.S. weapons corporations after World War II, which were huge then, were very much interested in keeping a good thing going, and that, again, it's the military-industrial congressional complex, and it's a follow-the-money thing.
Dan, let us gently thank you for your comment. Jim Carroll.
Well, I appreciate it. Drawing attention to the momentous Eisenhower speech, I'd like to make a couple of points about it. First of all, the somewhat polemical edge in the subtitle of my book, which is
The
Pentagon and
Rise.
The Disastrous mm-hmm. Rise of American Power, comes from Eisenhower, comes from that speech. Disastrous rise is his phrase. And you're absolutely – I didn't know what you just reported. I'm interested to hear it, that the word congressional was stricken from the speech. It makes sense because, of course, what he was warning of doesn't work without Congress's active participation. But not just Congress, the academy, the labor movement, the broad economy. What Eisenhower was warning of was fully rampant by that time, 1961. And remember what it was. In 1950, there were 200 atomic bombs in the American arsenal. By 1960, there were 19,000 nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. most of them hydrogen bombs, in the American nuclear arsenal. By what standard is there any rationality in that? You see what it is? It is that itself is the evidence of this unchecked momentum that I and in his own way, Colonel Basevich is are warning of. And Eisenhower saw it clearly and denounced it. let me just conclude this response by also acknowledging that what Eisenhower was doing there, alas, is yet another example of what Robert J. Lifton has called the retirement syndrome. Mm-hmm. People who preside over the construction of a massively dangerous institution denounce the danger as they're leaving responsibility for it. And we've seen that happen again and again through this history.
What's the burning heart of the kind of motivating view of the world here? You write about what you call the apostolic succession of generations of thinkers who have embraced the Pentagon and this worldview that you're so opposed to. Describe that succession to it, and what is the idea that's passed down generation to generation that keeps it going?
I'm not certain which of my sources made this observation. Perhaps it was James Mann, but one of them observed that the World War II generation of American leaders and the post-World War II generation came out of Wall Street. The Kennedy era generation of leaders came out of the academy. The Bush II era of national leaders has come out of the Pentagon. The defining experience that so many of these people have had have been the Pentagon or the militarized State Department.
You write a succession that comes right on down to Paul Wolfowitz from very early on. And what is it that's passed?
What's passed is a paranoid view of the world, a readiness to see the world in worst-case contexts again and again, to see what's out there as a threat, and we prepare for the threat in ways that then threaten us more than any threat ever could. I'm thinking of James Forrestal, the first Secretary of Defense, mm-hmm. who came down from Wall Street. His protégés were George Kennan and Paul Nitze. When George Kennan, quote, went soft, unquote, he was shunted aside in favor of Paul Nitze. Paul Nitze had protégés of his own, including especially Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. They, in turn, had protégés of their own. Rumsfeld and Cheney are brought into this, what I call, apostolic succession. Paul Nitze, in a way, embodies it down through the decades, a man who was the hawk of hawks serving eight separate presidential administrations. And, of course, the irony of Paul Nitze, who embodies this, always warning, as Forrestal was heard to cry not long before he committed suicide, embodying his paranoia, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. That's the embodiment of this mindset. The Russians are coming, the Russians are coming.
George is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, George, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I usually listen to On Point on a solar radio, so that's my little two cents for peace. I'm hoping that both commentators will remember Lewis Mumford's book, the second volume of The Myth of the Machine, published in 1974 after being serialized in The New Yorker, called The Pentagon of Power, in which, as an architectural critic, Mumford said, you have to blow up the Pentagon before the United States can be fully free.
How did you interpret what he meant by that, George?
I think he was looking at the Pentagon, that disastrous building architecturally, as the full symbol of militarism.
Simple as that, but as deep as that. James Carroll, an architectural...
Well, you know, it's a very interesting observation. I do believe the Pentagon looms in very important, unconscious ways in the American imagination. Its place on the river, it's evoking buildings all out of scale to anything human.
It was the biggest office building that had ever been built when it was put up.
Yes, and there is an irony, of course, in the fact that it was surpassed only in 1972. By the World Trade Center, and it resumed its place as the largest building in America by square footage on 9/11. I would just draw attention to the first skeptic about the Pentagon was Franklin Roosevelt himself. He did not want a massive building. He was afraid of the kind of bureaucracy it would house. He did not want a permanent building. In fact, he ordered the Army to make it temporary. That order was disobeyed. He intervened with the Army in its siting. He did not want—he wanted it, actually, to be in Washington. He didn't want it outside of the symbolic center of executive power.
On its own across the river.
Roosevelt's ambivalence about the Pentagon, I would say that his dark worry all came true. The design itself is an accident, interestingly enough. I mean, mythically, much has been made of the fact of the five-sided building evoking fortress architecture of the past. Mm-hmm. The five sides is an accident. The original site was just at the place today where Memorial Bridge goes into Arlington, just right below the Lee Memorial. Roosevelt didn't want the War Department headquarters on the axis line between Lee and Lincoln, which he regarded as the symbol of American reconciliation. He ordered it moved downriver. By the time it moved, architects had already drawn up a plan, and it was five-sided to accommodate a road that ran right there. They evened up the five sides to form a true pentagon. They were in such haste to build the building that they didn't draw up a new plan, even though the new site didn't require it.
Andrew Bacevich, I understand the iconic quality of the Pentagon. Lewis Mumford may look at it and be horrified, and yet I don't find myself completely caught up in the kind of mythic interpretation of it. I mean, the world is a dangerous place. There has always been war. Let us strive toward peace, but a country as large as the United States is going to have a military. So where is a line crossed here? If you're saying a line is crossed, where is it?
Well, I think this may be where James Carroll and I part company. There was one sentence in his book, is in the introduction, that just really struck me, and it's this: always the Pentagon remains the nation's sacred temple. And that really brought me up short. I mean, I'm not sure we have a sacred temple, but I think I'd argue that if we do, that the sacred temple is probably Disney World, or the sacred temple is the New York Stock Exchange, or the sacred temple is some place in Los Angeles that we would locate as the epicenter of our celebrity culture. And my point there is, I really don't think that blowing up the Pentagon, either figuratively or literally, gets to the heart of the matter. We are the way we are, and we have come to place this emphasis, this exaggerated emphasis on military power, for reasons that go far deeper than this building. It seems to me that those of us who are seriously concerned about the distortions of our military policy need to be willing to ask deeper and more critical questions that I think have to go back to the structure of our political economy, to those things that we have come to assume are essential to the American way of life. By extension, we have come to believe that only through maintaining and exercising supreme military power can that way of life be maintained. I think that's wrong.
You look to oil, look to...
Precisely. Mm-hmm. I mean to vastly oversimplify, mm-hmm. and yet to get mm-hmm. to one piece of the larger truth, mm-hmm. we've come to believe that we have a birthright to have cheap gas to put in our oversized cars so we can commute 50 miles to our oversized houses in the suburbs. And we have come to believe that it is through the exercise of military power that we're going to maintain that. That's the big reckoning, it seems to me, that demands to be confronted. And only when we as a people are willing to do that, Lord knows the politicians aren't willing to do it, only when we as a people are going to do that are we going to be able to come to some more realistic understanding of what force can do and cannot do for us.
James Carroll, here we're back to the chicken and egg question and the role the Pentagon plays. You see it as a fuel cell in there, always leaning toward that, too hungry.
I locate the mysterious source of this dark and negative energy there, it's true. And I confess I may be speaking somewhat mystically here. I mean, I'm trying to take seriously the object itself. When I call it a sacred temple, I take your point, Andy, about Disney World, or there are other, the World Trade Center had its character as a sacred temple as well. But what I'm thinking, for example, of in the tradition of world religions, the temples always had a place called the Holy of Holies, into which lay people were never allowed. They were wrapped in secrecy. Mm-hmm. They were wrapped in secrecy. There's a mm-hmm. way in which the Pentagon has that quality, especially now. You can barely drive within sight of the place without feeling the security apparatus.
The perimeter is so fiercely guarded.
It's true, for understandable reasons. But when we talk about blowing up the Pentagon, not my image, I don't particularly mm-hmm. maybe it was Mumford's, but it's not one I associate with. But I do believe that it isn't simple idealism, softness, the opposite of realism, to talk about dismantling the system. We do have, in fact, an example of such dismantling, which we, again, this history is full of things we Americans don't reckon with. Mm-hmm. We have not reckoned with what the Soviet Union did.
When Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev sat down, and out of that
Gorbachev
came...
Gorbachev, with his magnificent partner, Ronald Reagan, perhaps people will be surprised to find the hero. If there's one hero of House of War, it's Ronald Reagan in this history.
Because?
Because he gave Gorbachev what he needed to preside over the end of the Cold War system, and to turn the nuclear arms race
mm-hmm,
around.
Mm-hmm.
Reagan and Gorbachev... In an odd and surprising way, wound up in a magnificent partnership. But the Soviet Union dismantled its overwhelmingly imperial, tyrannical military system. I don't have any illusions about Russia today, although I would say that Dick Cheney is playing the old game of the Russians are coming. The Russians are coming again from recent news. But look what happened in Moscow. Look what happened in Belarus and Kazakhstan and Ukraine, three countries, new countries that renounced nuclear weapons,
mm-hmm.
had them and gave them up.
And it's hardly the military superpower any longer.
And Russia is not a military superpower, not altogether for its own will because of the economic collapse. I understand that. But there was another way for the Soviet Union to go, which Americans don't particularly reckon with. That collapse, that economic confrontation, the truth of their economic hollowness could have been dealt with in a far different way. Empires in the past have confronted moments like that by being more belligerent,
mm-hmm.
looking for more enemies outside. Go out fighting, go out in a terrible cataclysm of destruction. Moscow did not do that. America has not effectively changed its stance in the world since the Cold War ended. That's the question. Why not?
But the most recent reason, George Bush would say, is because we were attacked.
Well, there's the most important case in point. What happened on 9/11? 9/11 was taken, the assault by this criminal group of misfit nihilists. That event was taken as an act of war. Those were practically the first words out of George Bush's mouth.
Mm.
This is an act of war. This is war, he said. The next day, Thomas Friedman in the New York Times published a column called World War III.
What did it look like to you, James Carroll?
It looked like the worst crime I'd ever seen perpetrated anywhere, the worst single crime. It was a criminal act, and it cried out for an act of law enforcement, not an act of war. The United States of America should have been at the center of an unprecedented, swift, international act of law enforcement against al-Qaeda, against Osama bin Laden. Listen, we went to war and Osama bin Laden is still at large. We went to war and Afghanistan is still on the brink of chaos. We went to war and Iraq has brought us to the edge of a world disaster. War was not the answer to 9/11. Why did the American people go so quickly, so viscerally to war in response to 9/11? That's the question.
Melissa's calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Very well. What do you think, Melissa?
My question really has to do with more of the ethical element and how we're relating to one another and why American society is so willing to go to war and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's manipulation of the media in cahoots with the government in getting their agenda out there.
So you say, what, look to the media, and that's the driver here at bottom?
I don't know about at bottom. There's also got to be something about society's lack of contemplation. There's, I think, a really deep, this is funny, really deep superficiality.
And what about the danger that is in the world, Melissa? If the United States were more pacifistic, by some measure, do you think the world would be more peaceful, less dangerous, even to the U.S.?
Not one bit. I don't think pacifism is the answer. I think it needs to be more active enforcement, as was just said. More enforcement of the rules that are already in place instead of trying to make new rules in a way.
So slower to the war trigger, but more assiduous in following up a kind of new world order, one President Bush might have said. Jim Carroll?
Can I raise a question about this radical distinction we're drawing between realism and what's called pacifism or the maybe the soft view. I would say that realism has turned out not to be what the realists said it was for two generations. The realist view throughout the Cold War had nothing to do with how the Cold War ended. The totalitarian school of realists in America were dead wrong about the Soviet Union again and again and again. They missed it. I earlier described myself as a peacenik. I wouldn't say I'm a pacifist. Mm-hmm. Force is crucial. I'm talking about force exercised in the context of law, not war. I believe that there's another way to organize the world than the way we've organized it now. And the United States of America is an impediment to the true New World Order that is desperate to be born now, which is an order of international law, agreement, cooperation.
Andy Bacevich, you're the West Point man here. Well, where would you turn the needle? How would you organize the country in such a way as to maximize its chances of peace, happiness, and prosperity and minimize war?
Well, we're not going to have peace. I mean, I would rise to the defense of realists here, and I suppose it depends on how you define the term. I would argue that the true realists got it right, that George Kennan, really at the founding, sort of at the beginning of the Cold War, was an authoritative voice of realism who said that the Soviet Union represented a threat to U.S. national security interests, who said that a policy of containment patiently applied would ultimately reveal the contradictions of Marxism-Leninism, and at the end of the day that we would prevail. I think my telling of the story would be that, in a sense, that's what happened.
But today, our time is short, and I'm so interested. What's the balance that you would array in terms of military defense of this country and being open to something else? It's not purely militaristic, the thing you've warned against.
Well, my version of realism is in favor of military strength, and it's in favor of prudence. Let's get to specifics here. Was it appropriate and necessary for the United States to invade Afghanistan after 9/11? Emphatically, yes. Why? Because the Taliban had been harboring al-Qaeda and had rejected our demand that they cough up Osama bin Laden. It was absolutely necessary for us to make a clear demonstration of the fact that any regime harboring terrorists that threatened to us would suffer dire consequences.
So that was done
that
in
was
Iraq?
A smart war. Beyond that, I think that James Carroll's description of how to perceive al-Qaeda was dead on. We should have viewed it as an international criminal conspiracy that required an international police response. Police response is not guys in blue suits with revolvers. Police response is intelligence agencies, special operations forces,
tough,
rooting out every last member of that organization and running them down.
James Carroll, we've got a minute left. The face you would have the United States show to the world then, what would it look like that's realistic?
Well, let's return to the central problem of our time, which is nuclear weapons. This whole generating momentum I'm talking about gets radioactive early on with the establishment of Los Alamos, the use of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima, and nuclear weapons are the curse that threaten us today. The thing that made al-Qaeda terrifying
next,
was the possibility that these nihilists would wind up with an atomic bomb or a nuclear weapon. And now, what are we doing about it? What needed to happen in 1945 still needs to happen, which is an international control of nuclear weapons and nuclear production. The United States of America is still an obstacle to that. And by re-embracing nuclear weapons, as Washington is doing, we are making proliferation inevitable. We have become the nation of nuclear proliferation.
It's a provocative book, and you make the argument well, James Carroll. The new book is House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power. James Carroll, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich, wonderful to have your perspective today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot.
Andrew Bacevich, author of The New American Militarism and American Empire. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.